Hello and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. In tonight's show, we'll be reviewing the World Cup. I'm Anthony Kendrick, and I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Prickett.
Hi, how are you all? Hope you're all well.
Yeah, I'm all right, thank you. Enjoyed the World Cup.
It was brilliant. Surely no one didn't enjoy it, who only watched it anyway. It's certainly the best tournament memory. The World Cup that made me fall in love with football was Italia 90, which on reflection was actually a pretty awful tournament. Nowhere near as entertaining as this. So for those who are being introduced to the game off the back of this tournament, the standards they've been set are really high. This was a great tournament, truly great tournament.
So was Italia 90 the first World Cup you remember? Do you mind if I ask how old you were then, roughly?
Yes, I'm one. No, I was nine.
Okay.
So it was the first one, and I wasn't really into football.
Yeah.
But it was, I sort of remember watching some of the games up until the semi-final. And the semi-final, it was everyone must watch this.
Mm.
Even people who had no interest in football.
Yeah.
They watched the semi-final. And that's what happens when you hit that point, which is why it's so important and so good that we did reach the semi-final this year.
Yeah, I get you. For me, the first World Cup I saw was the 2002. I would have been 10 at the time. I remember it being about players for me at that age. I think Beckham, and mainly Beckham, but Owen as well, being the two sort of main players. And it was every kid on the playground wanted to be Beckham or Owen, and that's what I remember. But, we got to the quarters, and the goofy teeth guy, as I remember we called him on the playground, Ronaldinho, scoring that fluky or incredible goal, depending on your point of view.
The biggest thing for me in terms of players after Italia 90 was basically if you had a shot and you kicked it over the bar, everyone just shouted Waddle. Which is a bit harsh, but that's what happened.
Yeah. We'll look at England this World Cup. I would say we definitely exceeded any expectations in reaching the semi-final.
Well, there weren't any expectations, were there?
Well, I think people were saying getting out the group stage was an expectation, and then, perhaps a quarter final would be nice, but I don't think anyone said semis.
No one predicted a semi-final. No one expected a semi-final, which is part of why it was as good as it was.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the players that were in the team, the first team, I think only Ashley Young is 30-something. But then the squad as a whole, it's a very young squad, and I think it bodes very well for the future. Ashley Young, Jamie Vardy. But other than that, I think pretty much everyone else.
Cahill,
yeah, I suppose. Very young squad, and it bodes very well for the next, for the future. I know Gareth Southgate was saying it's about looking forward to, say, the next World Cup or something.
Yeah, I was loath to say, once we got to the semi-finals, a lot of people were starting to say, oh, we've overachieved already, it's a fantastic achievement. And I was just loath to say that, because for me, once you start saying that, you're already starting at the back of your head to go, it's okay, we can stop now.
Mm.
And you can't, because Southgate was absolutely right. You get the opportunity, you've got to go for it. You may never get it again. The golden generation didn't get any further than the quarterfinal.
Mm.
So World Cup semi-finals are not common things, not really for anybody. Unless you're Brazil.
Yeah.
Brazil, Germany, perennial quarter semi-finalists. Everybody else, it's a bit of a toss-up.
Mm. I thought in every interview Gareth Southgate did, he just always seemed to say the right thing, when he was getting some difficult questions. And he kind of, he didn't seem to think the semi-finals is enough. He wanted to go on and win it. But having said that, he was very careful not to say, he expects us to win it, or we've got to win it, or anything like that. I thought he did a very good job in dealing with the media.
Well, he's a simply, he's a very smart guy. He's an intelligent human being. He's seen it as a club manager, seen it as a player. He's done international football before. He spent a lot of time around the setup at St George's Park. He's answering questions in an intelligent and thoughtful manner, which we haven't had for a while. Mm. Let's be honest. Not that necessarily because they haven't been intelligent and thoughtful, but partially because English hasn't been their first language for some of them, which always has an effect. Or, you can question how intelligent and thoughtful people think Sam Allardyce is or was. Yeah, he's a different breed of person to that which has come before.
In terms of the players, who really stood out the most for you in the England squad?
I think our best player was Jordan Pickford.
Uh-huh.
Some players looked good, like Trippier looked very good, but I'm not sure if that was a little bit false. He did very well in his position. He didn't do an awful lot of defending because Kyle Walker did a lot of covering in behind him. And as soon as Walker went out, as you saw against Belgium, the goals came from that area.
Mm.
But going forward, his delivery was fantastic. His passing was excellent. But the outstanding player for me was Jordan Pickford. I think he would have been quite close to goalkeeper of the tournament.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking about that myself. I was, I've written up a team of the tournament, which I'll release on the website at some point. But yeah, I was tempted to put Pickford in. I ended up putting Courtois in, but yeah, I thought Pickford had a very good World Cup. Harry Maguire as well is the obvious one to say as well. But I think, within the three of them, they're all players who going into the World Cup we didn't expect anything from. And I think Kieran Trippier in particular, people. Before the five at the back, everyone sort of expected Kyle Walker to be our right back, and you wouldn't have thought Trippier would start.
I know, and there's some people who were pushing for Trent Alexander-Arnold to be the first choice right wing back. So he cemented himself very, very quickly, and after that, there's no room for debate. And another player who I'm really pleased that the public's perception of him has changed is Jordan Henderson.
Mm.
I've always been a supporter of Jordan Henderson. I remember years ago, Mark Lawrenson hammering Henderson when they were talking about passing statistics. He said, oh, his passing statistics are 80, 90%. And Lawrenson said, oh, well, it's easy to have those sort of stats when you only pass it sideways.
Mm.
And all I thought was, isn't that all that Xavi did? it is simple passes, but actually Henderson's range of passing is much greater than that. And if you watch him play regularly, you'll see what he can do. He often plays within himself for the team.
And
it's all the little niggly jobs, winning the ball, chasing people down, getting the blocks. I think the block he made in the Sweden game was quite a big moment for him because it was one of the more obvious examples of his work. And I want to say a big moment for him, big moment for the public's perception of him.
Mm. I think in general there's two things to consider with Henderson. Firstly, he was effectively playing in midfield on his own with Lingard and Ali getting so high up the pitch. And also, secondly, I think if you compare him to Eric Dier, who played in the same role on occasion, the difference between them was huge. Eric Dier looked so out of his depth, and he's not a bad player, but compared to Henderson, he looked woeful at this World Cup.
No, Dier was odd because he's a very good player, and he's been very good for England. But for some reason at this tournament, he looked like he was playing a different game to everybody else, or a different level of football. I don't really have an explanation for it. I'm not sure we really need an explanation for it. I'm sure he'll be back to his best quite soon. But yeah, the stark contrast between their performances probably helped with the perception of Henderson as well.
Mm-hmm. I've got to mention Harry Kane as well. There's a bit of debate about him. He's obviously won the Golden Boot with his six goals. But people have been critical of how he scored them goals. Where do you stand on that? Do you think, you know, he's got lucky scoring a hat trick and, you know, some penalties against and didn't score against any decent teams, or do you say, you know, look at the other Golden Boot winners and it's you can only beat what's in front of you sort of attitude, and anyone who wins it deserves it?
Do you remember Oleg Salenko in 1994?
I can't say I was old enough to remember, but I have read about him.
He scored 5 goals in 1 game and got a slice of Golden Boot.
Mm.
I don't remember a lot of criticism of him. The Golden Boot is not about have a quality of goal. It's not about the importance of goal. It's just about how many goals. The fact is, he scored more goals than anybody else, and that's all there is to it. It's not that's what the competition is. He scored more goals. It's like the team that wins the league, they got more points. It doesn't matter how they got them. Yeah. You don't get extra points for playing with more style. You don't get extra goals for scoring 5 outside the box. It's not worth 6 tap-ins.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way it works. Yeah. Okay, he picked up an easy hat trick. But again, if it's that easy, why didn't anyone else get a hat trick against Panama?
I agree. I think none of the other top strikers really stepped up. I don't think, you know, you look at some of the other sort of favourites to win it. You know, Lukaku maybe could have won it had his finishing been better, but there wasn't another striker who you could go out and say he deserved a Golden Boot, but he was unlucky. For me,
no, it's not like I could think of other players who kept hitting the post and or anything like that. I'm not. If we want to be critical of Harry Kane, it shouldn't be the goals he scored. It could be about his performances, and that at times he was far too deep, and he needed to be in the box at times when he wasn't. If we are being really picky. But he still got 6. He got 6 goals with doing things wrong or being in the wrong places, depending on how you look at it. So we could say, oh, maybe he'd have got 8. So you can't criticise him for scoring 6 goals.
No.
He scored 6 goals. It doesn't matter. It could have all gone in off his backside. He still scored 6 times.
No, I agree. I think the main driving factor is that it's disappointment that, you know, he didn't turn up in the knockout round. He scored the penalty, but other than that, I thought he was fairly anonymous against Croatia and against Sweden when we won. I think it's just mainly disappointment of that. I think is sort of clouding people's judgment.
I think he did have some good opportunities. I mean, the most recent one was against Belgium when Sterling had some excellent work to control the ball and lay it off, and Kane's got a clear sight of goal. He's kicked it into the ground and wide, and it happened a couple of times. Yeah, and he did miss a huge chance. I'll say he missed a huge chance. It was a brilliant piece of goalkeeping from Subasic to put his foot out and deflect the shot onto the post. But then maybe when he should have scored the first one anyway.
Our semi-final where we got knocked out to Croatia. Do you think Croatia were the better side on the night, or do you think we were unlucky?
I think Croatia were the better side. We were the better team for 25 minutes.
Yeah.
But look, how many years did Croatia play a 3-5-2? I mean, if you go back to when Steve McLaren was England manager and Bilic was Croatia manager, they used 3-5-2 then, and they've used it on and off. In between, they have a greater understanding of the system than we do, and of its strengths and weaknesses. And we were great for 20-25 minutes, and then they worked it out. They overloaded us in wide positions, either with the outside runner or the fullback overlapping, but more so with an inside movement, with an underlap, and they kept getting in, and we got forced further and further back. It just became a battle of the crosses, and eventually they scored, and it was coming, and it was coming, and it was coming, and there wasn't really a reaction to that, and that would be the next step for England moving forward.
Yeah,
greater tactical flexibility in those situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I think England, I think it's a promising World Cup for England. It almost reminds me a bit of, was it 2006, the German World Cup, when Germany won, got to the semis.
There is a positive for England in terms of building on this, which is the last two times they reached the semi-final, the manager was gone. So in 90, Robson was gone, and they knew it before the tournament was over. In 96, Venables was gone, and they knew that was going to happen before the tournament was over. So this time, the manager stays, so he can actually build on his own work rather than handing it on to someone else.
Croatia had a fantastic run to the final, where they were defeated by France. First of all, Croatia, you know, as we say, super run, in my opinion as well, deservedly beating England in the semi-final. I thought they played very well against Argentina and were unlucky in the final.
Very, very unlucky. Desperately unlucky. No, it was a brilliant performance in the final. They didn't get what they deserved, but France were always going to carry a threat against them because Mbappe was miles faster than anyone else. I mean, sometimes the game is really, really simple. Croatia had lots of possession, and because they had lots of possession, they ended up in really high positions, which was great for France because they just gave the ball to one of their central midfielders, which mainly was Pogba, slipped the ball forward, and then Mbappe just ran onto it. And the two goals in the second half were via Mbappe. It was his run. It was Pogba's pass that Mbappe ran onto and then cut back for Pogba to have two goes at it to score. And they were always going to have that threat. Now, the first half goals, they were a bit different.
I put a poll on the Twitter asking if the referee was correct to award a penalty. 46% believed it was a penalty. 54% said that it wasn't. So it's not far off a 50-50 split, you know, very slightly towards no. What was your thoughts?
I was about to say I'm surprised it wasn't even closer. I think it was just about, but I can see why it would be given, and I found the fence and I'm sitting on it now. You can see why it was given. You can see why people were furious that it wasn't. You know, if it had been your team, that's always a test for me. If it was England against Croatia and that happened, would be screaming for a penalty?
Well, I'm sure at the time players would be appealing. For me, it wasn't a penalty. I just don't think you can give it. You can be sure that from that distance he means it. I think it's such a big call to make. I would have given no penalty myself. I wouldn't have given the penalty myself. I would say the thing with VAR is you watch it in slow motion repeatedly and things look worse than they are.
Yeah. Yes. Same with tackles. Always the case with a tackle. It's suddenly, you know, it looked fine at the time, and then you watch it back and you watch it back and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And I think that's what's happened with the incident, because he didn't give the penalty initially.
Yeah. I think the thing to say as well is the fact he's not given a penalty, then VAR have said, hang on, you might want to have a look at this. In a referee's mind, you'd be thinking, hang on, they think it's a penalty, I should be given a... Or that would be playing on my mind anyway, you know.
Yeah. Psychologically, if they're telling me to look at it, they think it is.
Mm.
Just as you said. So if they think it is, maybe it is. So he's starting to sway immediately from... not a penalty to it is a penalty. So he's looking then for reasons to give it rather than reasons not to give it.
Mm-hmm. To play devil's... Go on.
It was such a fine margin, as the poll has shown. It's just the ref's unfortunate.
Yeah.
How often do you see one like that? Just like that one? Really rarely.
Mm.
So rarely. That's not your normal penalty area handball. You see more where the players headed it onto their own arm than ones like that, down where they're jumping, but he's actually handled it quite low down.
Mm.
So I have a great deal of sympathy for the referee in that situation.
I think sticking with sympathy for the referee, perhaps an argument for VAR is that, you know, outside of this World Cup, in a normal Premier League match, we're expecting referees to get these calls right, you know, in real time with one look at it. You're telling me you can tell me off the first look and be reasonably sure it's a penalty or it's not a penalty? It's just not possible. You cannot possibly say off a first look either way.
It was obscured by the player in front. So watching it on TV, I didn't even know it had hit his hand.
Mm.
Until it went to the replay, I wasn't sure what it had hit. I thought it might have hit his thigh or his hip,
mm,
or maybe even just come off his stomach. I didn't know it hit his hand.
Yeah.
So how's the ref meant to know?
Well, even if it was obscured, you know, and he does see it cleanly, you know, to give that decision in real time is, it's just not possible.
No, I mean, how do you know if it's intentional?
Yeah.
Don't get inside the player's head. You know when a player is like Suarez won against Ghana, you know that's intentional.
Yeah.
Of course, I think that's what it's for.
Mm.
That's what these penalty box handballs are for, that sort of thing. Or when a player has gone to make a tackle and they missed the ball and they stopped it with their hand. But even that's grey because they've gone, they've missed it, their hand's landed, the ball's hit their hand. Versus, I've missed the ball quick, I better stick my arm out, stop it.
Is this a misunderstanding of the VAR rule of a clear and obvious error before getting the referee to have another look at it?
I think the word is difficult, isn't it?
Because
what's clear and obvious? And clear and obvious to who?
Well,
that becomes an opinion, doesn't it? Again, doesn't it? Clear and obvious in whose opinion?
Well, I would say if 99, you know, something like the Suarez one, as you mentioned, or Henri's handball, or the hand of God, or something like that. That is, everyone knows that's handball. You know, 99.9% of people would, you know, say that's definitely handball, and there'd be no controversy about that. With this one, because it's a controversial decision, I would say that it's not a clear and obvious error, and therefore VAR should be nothing to do with it under the current rules.
The wording isn't a clear and obvious handball, it's a clear and obvious error.
Mm.
So there's straight away becoming a problem, because what's a clear and obvious error? We know what a clear and obvious handball is, but what's a clear and obvious error? So they're tying themselves in knots immediately. They'll probably need to go back to that wording, because people like to dig into it and go, well, actually, the meaning is this. They need to clean that up, and I'm sure they will.
Mm. I don't want to make the whole show about VAR, but I will ask, do you think overall at this tournament it was a success, and do you think it should be taken forward?
Yes, I think it was a success, and I have a feeling it's not being used in the Premier League this season, is it?
It's not, no. It's going to be continued to be trialled in a few FA Cup games and a few other games, but not.
I have a feeling that having watched the World Cup with it, it will be the first weekend when we're watching the football going, oh, VAR should have a look at that one. Oh, it's not there. I think, by and large, it has worked.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it does need, it needs a bit of tweaking, but I do, yeah, no, I agree. I think it's worked. I think one of the things that annoys me about it, though, is the people now, rather than protesting for fouls or whatever, they're all having a go at the ref and surrounding him to tell him to look at the video replay. I think it was the Iran game is the one that stands out for me, where they were surrounding the ref at several times and telling him he had to look at replays, and he gave a penalty. And because he was not because he was told to by the video assistants, because he was pressured into it by players, and I think it's setting a bit of a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, they're all turning into Uma Thurman, aren't they?
Mm.
Pulp Fiction. they're all just doing that, and that's one of the iconic moments. I think it was a Morocco player at the end of the game drawing the box and going, VAR was bullshit.
Mm. Okay, back to the. Just want to come back to the final and mention. You mentioned Mbappe and Pogba being the two stars. It was amazing to see Pogba perform so differently for France than he does for United. But on Mbappe, he's really announced himself. I'm sure a lot of people were aware of him for his exploits for PSG, but now he's really announced himself onto the world stage.
Yeah, and he did help Monaco win a league title not too long ago. I found it interesting because he's been around certainly as a major presence for two seasons. Did it just show that a lot of people see bits of highlights and read reports and stories and go, oh yeah, Mbappe, great player, and then they didn't actually watch him until the World Cup, and now they've watched him, they're like, wow, look at this player who I pretended to know about for 2 years but actually didn't.
It reminds you, think of the last World Cup where James Rodriguez won the Golden Boot, and he was somebody who was who I certainly was aware of before the tournament. You know, for a couple of years before, he'd had good seasons in Portugal and in France at Monaco, as it happens. But I think he joined Monaco for quite a big fee as well. I think it was about 40, 50 million before that. But he got his big move to Real Madrid on the back of that. Maybe this is a similar sort of example.
Yeah, I think so. But he was brilliant. His pace was obviously electrifying, but it's not just that. It was his movement, his positioning. He was clinical. He made good decisions. There's everything that you'd want from a forward of his type. We'll see what happens to him. Hopefully there's no injuries. Hopefully he stays fit, healthy, no external influences. Let's just see him fly.
And France, on the whole, they weren't one of my picks for the World Cup, to be completely honest. But they sort of melded as a team in the end. And several standout players, I think as well as the two we mentioned, Pavard, the fullback, the right back, I thought had a good tournament.
There's someone who you might go as a genuine revelation. Who was, now let's be honest, who was really familiar with Pavard before the tournament? I wasn't.
Well, he got into the team because their other right back, Sidibe, got an injury, so it was kind of a bit of fortune.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago he was playing Bundesliga 2. So that's a great story, a player emerging. And he was brilliant throughout. Great going forward, excellent defensively. And
scored that great goal as well.
Yeah, scored a stunning goal. Super tournament. The stuff of dreams for him, definitely.
Russia overachieved. They knocked out Spain, won a couple of games in the group stages and had a much better World Cup than many people thought they would, eventually getting knocked out in a penalty shootout. I was one of those that predicted, I can't remember to be honest, but a lot of people predicted Egypt and Uruguay to get through in the group stage ahead of them, but defied expectations.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people do is they look through the list of players. It's the logical and obvious thing to do. You look at the squads. You go through the Russia squad and you go, no one really stands out there. And that's generally because a lot of the players haven't had big moves or made impacts elsewhere. Cheryshev is a player that I'm sure a lot of people will be vaguely aware of because he's been in Spain for a long time. But don't think anyone was really aware. I wasn't aware of his shooting ability to the extent that he displayed during the tournament. I was aware he was very quick and very tricky, but he scored two of the best goals of the tournament.
Yeah.
Holovin, I'd heard a bit about, but didn't really know a lot about him. He was very good. So I think they surprised a lot of people, and based on the reports that I've seen and heard, they surprised themselves.
Yeah. I think the right back as well, Fernandez, he was somebody I was aware of. I watched him play against Man United a few times in the Champions League, but I thought he had a terrific tournament. Also their striker, Juba, big physical target man. He's somebody who I was aware of, but a lot of people didn't expect anything from him. But a very one-dimensional player, but effective at what he did.
No, it's interesting as the... Because France had one of those as well, didn't they? didn't have a shot on target for the whole tournament, but helped them win it. The target man had a little bit of a re-emergence in this tournament, I think. Quite a few. See, Lukaku, a slightly different type of target man, but again, a player you can bounce balls off. Mm-hmm. So we saw a bit of a re-emergence of a more static player. The focal point had been shifted into midfield for quite a long time because of the exploits of Spain and Germany. Mm. Now it shifts back to the forwards.
Yeah, Mandzukic as well at Croatia, and of course Kane, who we've mentioned. It's quite interesting actually, you think back, we would say about Kane and the Golden Boot race, and none of the strikers scored a lot of goals. However, we've just pointed out some, you know, target man players who had good tournaments.
They were vital to linking the play, so they were more that board for the ball to bounce off of and to take the attention of the players, while the more tricky, pacey, creative players played off of them. Maybe Sweden should have taken Zlatan.
Yeah. Any other teams really stand out for you as overachievers at this tournament?
Mexico and Japan are interesting ones, because did they overachieve or not? They reached the knockout phases. Did we expect that of them, or is that kind of what's expected? They're interesting for me. If Japan had beaten Belgium, I think we'd definitely have been talking about them. Mm. And they weren't very far off doing that. And Mexico, are we just thinking about what they did against Germany? Possibly we are, or I am. But it's not like they're a minnow.
Yeah.
Mexico, for a long time, have been rather good at football. Japan haven't, but they have done better at World Cups than they did at this one. So they performed well, but I'm not sure if they overachieved.
I think Japan, I wouldn't agree with Mexico, but Japan, I think, were very unlucky against Belgium. And to get out of their group stage where no one really thought they would, and to come so close against Belgium, I thought they were a bit unlucky. I think that's, well, maybe that's the thing, is overachieving, getting knocked out by a good side and being unlucky, you know, or is it maybe going another step, you know, or is it what stage of the tournament you get to, whether you play a good side or not?
Mm. By what measure are we overachieved? Part of Croatia, 100% overachieved.
Yeah.
No one said they'd reach the final. And then the other part of their narrative, of their very special story, is they've only got a very small population.
Mm.
So is that a part of the judgment on whether a nation overachieves? In which case, you can chuck Japan and Mexico out because they've got huge populations. Mm. And we need to look at Belgium. Belgium, with such a small population, to be developing the amount of quality that they have done and to finish third, it's an overachievement.
Yeah, I get you. Want to move on from there. We mentioned, we had a bit of a conversation before the World Cup. We were talking about different pundits, which has kind of led on to this. So decided to have a bit of a chat about some of the pundits we like and maybe don't like so much. First of all, we'll talk about the BBC. Obviously, I had Gary Lineker as their main host. Your thoughts on some of the pundits there? Anyone in particular you liked?
Yeah, Alan Shearer singing. I'm sure everyone must have seen the clip of Alan Shearer singing Lionel Richie. I feel that's enhanced my enjoyment of Alan Shearer a lot. He was getting better as a pundit anyway, but to see that side of him was great, I think. Who stood out? It's really difficult. For me, the standout pundit was not on the BBC, so we'll come to them. Overall, I felt BBC was better. It normally is. Mm. I quite like Zabaleta. I thought he was pretty good. Klinsmann was interesting because I don't know about you, but I always felt like he was on his best behaviour all the time. He felt like he was being really polite he was insightful, but at the same time, he was like he was holding back a little bit, and yeah.
I understand what you're saying. I think he kind of balanced it up a bit, because I did notice for England games in particular, and generally, it was all English pundits, and I quite liked having a foreign person on there. You know, it kind of balanced it up and sort of gave a different view on it, I thought. But yeah, I sort of agree with you. I was a bit on the fence with Klinsmann. I thought he was very supportive of England and how well we did and how much he wanted us to do well. But, he can't go on the BBC and say he hopes we lose or anything negative, you know, too negative, I suppose.
One of the joys of past World Cups has been foreign players coming in and being different to our normal sets of pundits. Mm. I mean, Saitov is always going to be the outstanding one for me. It's a shame the Dutch weren't there, because it meant we didn't get Saitov. I felt that the foreign pundits on the BBC, they didn't add as much this year as they have done in the past. I said I quite like Zabaleta, but it was more about he was very blunt about Argentina.
He was, yeah.
And he was very truthful, and I don't think anyone would disagree with anything he said. Cesc was a bit smarmy. Hmm. Arrogant, maybe. Hmm. I don't think he came across particularly well. Drogba was okay, but I didn't think he was particularly insightful. I think the BBC's best pundits were the ones who normally work for BT.
Yeah, Frank Lampard for me was the standout. I thought he came across very well, and he was more analytical, I think, than some of the other pundits who it was a bit... I think with Fabregas and Drogba, they're good examples, because they seem to only talk about what they knew. And by that, I mean the position. So Fabregas was a lot of the time just talking about midfielders, and which I suppose is fair enough. But I didn't get much from them about the overall game, if that makes sense.
No, I don't got a huge amount from them about their positions either. And I've seen Drogba talk about forward play before, and he's been really good, but... They seem to draft him in as the African specialist.
Yeah.
I can understand it, but I don't think they were getting the best out of him. Mm-hmm. Like Lampard has been excellent for quite some time. Ferdinand, I think, has been one who has improved on BT. I think his game has been raised by those around him, and he continued to be good for the BBC. And Keown was awful. Mm. Just throw that one in there, because Keown was just—he was more negative than Mark Lawrenson, somehow. But then he wasn't as negative as what was going over on ITV.
Yeah, no, I agree. There were a few bad pundits. Lawrenson with his—he made a comment about a dislocated shoelace, which made me laugh. Danny Murphy. I think he's okay in a studio, but he annoyed me as a co-commentator. Phil Neville as well, he's a weird one, because I sort of want to like him, and he seems like a nice guy in that, but I don't know what to make of him. He's such a... I don't know, maybe it's the United connection. I don't know.
Whoa. He's in an awkward position now as well, because he has to be careful what he says.
Mm, true.
Alex Scott was quite good. I think we should make mention, because both channels went and they got themselves a female pundit.
Yeah.
For whether they were doing that as a token gesture or whatever the reason was, there was quite a bit of criticism I noticed on social media for both of them.
Yeah.
But I thought Alex Scott was quite good. She might make a better presenter in the long run, a bit like what happened with Gary Lineker, because Lineker was initially a pundit, and then he stepped into the presenting chair and did really well. But I liked what I saw from Alex Scott. She was knowledgeable, she was intelligent, but she's got the kind of personality that I think will make her a good presenter for the BBC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I understand. I think the women were they were obviously knowledgeable in that, and they were fine. I don't think this sounds harsh, but I don't think there were anything special. You know, they didn't stand out in the memory for me, but they didn't disgrace themselves either. And they certainly weren't the worst pundits there either. So, Yeah, it, as far as I'm concerned, I'm fine with women pundits being on. I can tell there's someone you've got in mind on ITV. So, looking at their coverage, is there a particular standout for you? You seem to mention
standout in which way?
Let's start positively.
I really like Slaven Bilic.
Yes, yes, my favourite.
He's got the knowledge. He communicates it pretty well. And also, I quite like that he bats away the stupid questions just with a stupid answer of his own that just dismisses its importance. And it's unusual for a pundit to have that balance of knowledge and understanding and the passion. And he's got both. We could have Bilic on every day. Every match of the day, every time BT are on, Sky Sports get him in to replace Thierry Henry. I don't think anyone would have grounds for complaint.
They do have him on occasionally. I know they had him and Neville on a few times when Carragher was away. But yeah, no, I absolutely love Bilic. He's my favourite by far. The one thing I was disappointed they didn't have him in the studio for the England Croatia game. I was disappointed he wasn't in the studio a bit more towards the end. He was sort of put aside. He was in the stadium in the later games rather than in the studio, which disappointed me because yeah, he was my favourite pundit as well. Yeah, I'm sorry I've not got a different favourite. It would have made a more interesting podcast, but yeah, I can't disagree with Bilic.
Well, arguably he was the only one on ITV, he was any good.
What about Neville, Gary Neville?
I thought he was really... He was not at his Sky Sports standards.
I agree.
I thought he was much more miserable. And I don't know. I have a gut feeling that was Roy Keane dragging him down to his level.
Yeah.
Keane's just getting worse. And we've mentioned this last time. He's becoming a parody of himself. And I loved it when Ian Wright, who he wasn't great during this tournament, when Ian Wright just took the mickey out of him, because he clearly got fed up with Keane's negativity. And it wasn't particularly mature or bright or intelligent what he did, but someone had to do it. They really did, because you know, when someone is that negative all of the time, even if they're talking sense, it loses its impact. And it's just a drone. It's a monotonous drone of negative, boring rubbish.
You see, I actually thought Keane was okay. I thought I quite liked Roy Keane at this tournament. I know what you mean. In the past, he's been almost Sutton-like, just almost spiteful just for the sake of it. Whereas here, I thought, and particularly that discussion he had with Ian Wright, which was all over social media, you know... we could have been in a final, and I thought he had a very valid point, and I think as well, it's kind of going back to maybe it's partly because he was the only foreigner, you know, non-English pundit on, it kind of balanced things up a bit. But I didn't think he was as spiteful as he has been in the past. On Gary Neville, I would say he certainly wasn't as good at this tournament. Maybe it was because he didn't have his board, his tools on him, you know, his I think he's a better I thought he was better. He co-commentated a match or two, and I think he's better as a co-commentator than a studio pundit. He picks a lot more up during a game, and you spot more things in the game with him as co-commentator.
They missed the trick. They should have just used him in that role all the way through.
Yeah. Well, for the England games particularly, instead of...
Evra was okay.
He did let himself down, though. I don't know if you saw his incident with Eni Aluko.
Yes.
Where he applauded and said, very good. It was quite patronising, I thought, but...
Ryan Giggs I'd forgotten about, but he was there.
Yeah.
Make of that as you will. Ian Wright, I thought, regressed. Because during the season, I thought he'd really improved as a pundit. He'd gone from his cheerleading to actually being quite insightful about forward play, a bit like we talk about Drogba. But I thought he regressed back to cheerleader during this tournament, which is a bit of a shame. Lee Dixon was there. didn't think he was great. But ITV did have one jewel in their commentary crown, which was McQuaid champion.
Yeah, I read about this. Apparently they've worked together since, I believe it was 98. They've been together. I didn't realise they'd worked together for a long time, those two. But yeah, I'd never really heard Ally McCoy's commentate before. I'd never noticed him, but he was fantastic to listen to.
When I started getting into football, I'm going to sound really old now, I relied on radio.
Yeah.
So it was Five Live. It had just become Five Live. And Monday night was Champion Sport. He was the presenter on a Monday night. So Monday night football was him, and he commentated on games on Saturdays. So he was, for me, he was a very familiar voice. He's always been a quite understated commentator, a bit like Barry Davis. Obviously not as good as Barry Davis, but a little bit in that style. And he and McCoy gelled brilliantly. As you say, they've been working together for a long time. And they made some of the less interesting games worth watching. Mm-hmm. And if that's not what a commentary team is supposed to do, I don't really know what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So if you were to look at the whole thing, which broadcaster's coverage did you prefer?
BBC. As I say, and I can't remember a tournament where it hasn't been that way, which always seems to be that the BBC come out on top.
I remember,
for me,
yeah. I remember Bilic when it was his first tournament working for ITV, and I thought their coverage was amazing. I think it was a Euros, and they were sat on top of a cafe or on top of a building outside. It might have been Brazil World Cup, but yeah. I thought ITV had a few of the better pundits, but the BBC were much better set up. I think maybe having four pundits in a room was too much. I'm not sure. But yeah, overall, I thought ITV had a few better pundits, but the BBC's overall coverage was perhaps better. I put another poll on Twitter asking people whose they preferred, and 81% went with the BBC and only 19 for ITV Sport. So, yeah.
I think overall, there's nothing wrong with ITV's coverage. Well, actually, what they did, their coverage, their packages, etc. I don't know how you can draw make a real difference between the two, because they basically do the same thing. And they're all very, very skilled people. So the packages and all that stuff, it's going to be neck and neck. It's just going to come down to what happens in the studio. And actually, I don't, as good as the World Cup was, I don't think it was a vintage World Cup for pundits. It wasn't really those people who grabbed you and thought, yeah, I'm being given a real education and insight here. This time around.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. It seems a sad way to decide to... we decided to do a podcast about pundits. That seems quite a sad way to end the discussion, though.
Well, we've been spoiled a little bit, because Match of the Day has improved this year. Mm-hmm. I think Match of the Day has improved quite significantly. And BT, on their live coverage, their Champions League coverage, Saturday night, they have gone up a level. And then we've got what was happening on Monday Night Football. So we've been spoilt this season. We've had a really high level of punditry, of insight. We felt like we're being let in, I think, to a different part of the game that we weren't being shown before. And I think we wanted more of that at the World Cup, and we didn't get it.
I agree. The domestic coverage has massively improved, and perhaps because of that, it seemed a bit more lacklustre. So I guess the other argument to make is, with a World Cup, they have to make it more accessible to people who don't follow football, whereas if you're watching Monday Night Football, the chances are you watch the Premier League most weeks.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I can remember Clive Tilsley talking about his early days as a commentator, and he was saying that he used the word obviously a few times, and he was pulled up by the head of ITV Sport, and he said, obvious to who? You've got to remember that you, this might be your 50th or 150th game as a commentator, but there's going to be at least one person who this is the first game they've ever watched.
Yeah.
So why would it be obvious to them? So, yeah, you're right. They might have to tone it down or peel it back a bit, especially during the live broadcasts, to appeal to a wider audience, a wider degree of footballing experience.
And especially for the England games as well, you know, because there's going to be a lot of people watching that who that's the only football they ever watch.
Yeah. So did they choose the right pundits for that job?
Well, I suppose we need to ask some people who don't watch much football and see what they thought, maybe. I don't know.
They're probably not going to be listening to this podcast.
No, perhaps not. Just before we finish, I hope you've enjoyed our pundits discussion, by the way. I just want to ask, what was your standout moment from this World Cup? Whether it's a game, a particular goal, a moment, I don't know.
I've written down a few. I will probably always remember the Argentina-France game.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the Portugal-Spain game was quite special because of the sheer quality of that game. I think the quality of the Portugal-Spain game was slightly better than the Argentina-France game.
Mm-hmm.
And it kicked off the World Cup, really. I know the fixtures started the night before, but then it just exploded into life. The other one would be Croatia picking Argentina apart. I'm mentioning Argentina again, losing, but Croatia really, really was superb in that game. I know we've got their exploits of the knockout stages and the unfortunate defeat in the final, and that's probably what's going to be remembered, but they were brilliant. They completely dominated Argentina. Rakitic in particular was fantastic, and Modric got player of the tournament, and he pretty much ran every game. But in this one, Rakitic was absolutely fantastic. He's normally second fiddle or third fiddle or fourth fiddle because he's got Modric in his international team, and then domestically he's had Neymar, Messi, Suarez all ahead, picking up the headlines ahead of him. It was great to see him being centre stage.
I thought he was every bit as good as Modric in this tournament, and I think it does make you think whether it was Modric having the bigger reputation that won him player of the tournament instead of Rakitic. You know, had they both come in as unknowns, say, or both with a similar reputation, whether Rakitic would have been in with more of a shout.
It's possible, and he's going to be unlucky probably forever, but he's just a little bit behind, or seen as being that little bit behind everyone else he plays with.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame, but he was definitely the standout in that Argentina game, and Croatia were brilliant in that game.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think the Belgium comeback against Japan will be something I remember.
The counter-attacking, that counter-attack will be a moment that everyone remembers, mm-hmm. I think, as well. You're definitely right to bring that up.
I think Croatia, their comeback against England, as annoying as it was and as heartbreaking as it was, that for me was a fantastic second half performance from Croatia. It was such a good performance, and I think, you know, trying to take my England hat off here, that's something I'll certainly remember.
Oh yeah, well, I don't think we're going to forget it. I don't think any England fans watching it are going to forget that. But they did put in a real performance. I know this is what happens when it's your team that loses. It becomes about how your team lost rather than how good the other team were.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably will never get the credit they deserve for that.
On that note, I think we've reached the end of the show. Unless there's anything else you wanna mention, anything?
Don't know. There's some of the shocks of the tournament. I mean, we haven't mentioned that's something that this tournament will be remembered for.
Mm.
The big names being knocked out and the surprises. We mentioned Mexico earlier beating Germany. Germany getting knocked out. Argentina's struggles. You know, it was a tournament for shocks, and that's what made the first phase as exciting as it was.
Yeah, yeah. And Spain, of course, against Russia, not everyone you know, expected a 4-0 or, you know, some big scoreline, you know, a Spain win, a comfortable Spain win, and it didn't happen.
Didn't they? Spain went ahead early, and I remember watching it, and I think I said to someone, well, that's that then. It certainly wasn't. So this tournament had a bit of everything. I think it really did. And to throw up as entertaining a final as it did, just capped it off perfectly.
I'll put a poll up on Twitter asking, seeing what our listeners think of favourite pundits. I think Slaven Bilic is obviously one. Who do you think should be the others in this poll?
Lampard.
Yeah.
Ferdinand.
I guess we should try and think of another ITV pundit for balance, but it's
Ferdinand or Shearer.
Yeah.
I might actually go just Lampard and Shearer there, and Bilic.
You're struggling.
I'm struggling from ITV.
We'll put Ali McCoist on. He deserves a. He wasn't a pundit as such, but he was talking football. So we'll put McCoist on.
You can put Keane on if you want.
I don't think he was as good as McCoy. I thought he was. He had a decent tournament, but he wasn't at the level of any of these. So we'll put on Bilic, Lampard, Shearer, who just edges out Ferdinand, and McCoist, Ali McCoist, and we'll see if you know. We never know. You might find the listeners all disagree and think we should have put up Roy Keane or Ryan Giggs or some, or Phil Neville or something.
Or Henrik Larsson, who was there as well.
Forgettable.
That's the problem. I think most of them are forgettable. Martin O'Neill. He was brilliant in 1998. That's 20 years ago, bro.
Alright, well, I hope you've enjoyed listening to the show. You can follow us on Twitter at V2 Sport Network. You can follow us at @Ant_Kendrick and at Peter Prickett. I'll put the links in the description. Thanks for listening. It's goodbye from me and goodbye from Peter.
Bye.